Moreover, it should be stressed that it was the reorganization of the French state along so-called absolutist lines which ultimately allowed France to realize its enormous potential as a great power and become the dominant state in Europe for more than a century. In earlier lectures, I mentioned that as late as the end of the Middle Ages, most Europeans could appreciate the fact that France was the 800-pound gorilla of Europe. It's really only during the later 16th, and really especially in the 17th century, that potential is realized, and it's clearly realized in conjunction with this process of what's often called absolutism. And for that reason, that the French model was so widely admired and imitated, and the fact that the French state had such an influence, whether appreciated or not, on the rest of Europe, that it seems to me that the development of the 17th century French state has to be seen as an issue of pivotal importance in all of European history. It has an importance that transcends the mere national history of France itself. Now, where we left off when discussing the French Wars of Religion at the end of the 16th century, we left off with the conversion of Henry of Navarre to Catholicism in the year 1593, and the promulgation of the Edict of Nantes in 1598, which issued certain kinds of important guarantees for the Huguenot minority, that is to say, the Calvinist Protestant minority in France. It is important, it seems to me, in analyzing Henry's conversion to Catholicism, not to reduce it merely to an act of expediency, of political opportunism. Now, for Henry himself, for the man himself, the abjuration of Protestantism may in fact have been nothing more than a kind of political expediency. He's notorious for having said Paris, or at least alleged to have been said, Paris is worth a mass. But I think it really bears repeating, or at least bears stressing, that for the political nation as a whole, for those elements of French society who counted, whose opinions mattered to the monarchy, Henry's conversion represented a renewal of one of the deepest traditions of the French monarchy. That is to say, the principle that there could only be one religion in France, the Roman Catholic religion, and that the king had to be the foremost defender of this religion. Henry himself would ultimately be assassinated in the year 1610 by a Catholic fanatic who was unconvinced of the sincerity of his conversion to Catholicism. Indeed, this would be the 20th attempt on Henry's life. And it should be said that this did prompt a kind of backlash spearheaded by the Parlement of Paris, that is to say, the most senior and the most prestigious of all French law courts. The Jesuit order, the order of Catholic priests, was expelled from France, at least briefly. The Jesuits had written a lot of tyrannicide tracts in the late 16th century, advocating the right of people to strike down tyrannical kings. This made them suspect in the eyes of many monarchists, so they were briefly expelled from France. And indeed, at the meeting of the French Estates General in the year 1614, it was declared that the French kings held their power from God alone. No power, whether temporal, that is to say earthly, or spiritual, that is to say an ecclesiastical power like the Pope, could deprive their kings, the kings, of their sovereignty or release a subject from his or her oath of obedience. So at least the Estates General. It should be stressed, however, that this, what I've called a backlash in the aftermath of Henry's assassination, was not an anti-Catholic backlash. The fact that people wanted to shore up and stress the power of the monarchy in no way implied any greater toleration or sympathy for the Protestant minority. What the political nation wanted above all in the aftermath of Henry's assassination was order, not religious diversity. And therefore, at the self-same meeting of the Estates General in 1614, where the divine right of French kings was proclaimed, the clergy issued a simply blunt request for the absolute prohibition of the exercise of the Reformed religion. That is to say, they issued a demand for the revocation of the Edict of Nantes of 1598. Now, in this kind of climate, and under the kind of pressure which followed, the Huguenot minority reacted in a fairly predictable way. That is to say, they rebelled. They rebelled in 1614 against the crown, and they rebelled again in the year 1618. But what is interesting about the Huguenot uprisings of the early 17th century is that the wider political context was now quite different from what had obtained during the later 16th century during the Wars of Religion. King Louis XIII, the son and successor of Henry IV, and Louis would reign between 1610 and 1643, he was in a much stronger position than his 16th century predecessors had been. And in a series of military campaigns between the years 1620 and 1622, Louis XIII would break the back of the resistance and suppress all Protestant political assemblies in France. This reconquest, if you will, culminated with the capture of La Rochelle, the last Huguenot fortress, which surrendered in 1628 after a three-year siege. And I think it's sort of worth noting parenthetically that this is the actual context of Alexandre Dumas' The Three Musketeers, the siege of La Rochelle in the late 1620s.